And I'm joined now by Fevzi Turkalp, who's the editor of GadgetDetective.com and host of the Gadget Detective podcast, to talk about some of the technological developments, including mobile phones for children and AI, which we've been talking about both of those things this morning. Morning, Fevzi.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask you, first of all, about another story as well, the Chinese spy balloons. I just wonder whether you can shed any light at all on how that might work, at least from a sort of tech point of view.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Well, from a tech point of view, it's all about telemetry, the ability for it to make observations, visual observations, but also radio frequencies, heat signatures. It's very interesting that it appears to be hovering over Montana, because Montana is the home to a lot of the US's nuclear missiles. For American missiles to hit, for example, Russia, the quickest way is over the North Pole, so they tend to site them in the north of the country, and Montana is known to be a place where they have banks of those missiles. So it could be that. I mean, I think the politics of it is quite fascinating as well. The timing of it, just before a US official is due to visit China, and just after America have announced that they're going to have four brand new military bases in the Philippines. And a balloon of this nature is very visible. There are other ways of gathering that telemetry, and I can't help but think that as well as gathering the telemetry, it's all about sending a message, a form of retaliation for what they're doing, and to put America on notice that they're not going to take what Chinese would see as their interference in that part of their part of the world as being taken lying down. I think that's what it's about. But in terms of the science of it, you can imagine that thing's the size of three double-decker buses across. It's huge. There's going to be a huge amount of technology in there. It's interesting, isn't it, that the Americans have chosen not to shoot it down, because it's in the stratosphere, so it's above the level at which aircraft fly. But before you hit space, it's that there. Difficult to shoot it down without risking life and limb on Earth, because you can't really predict where the pieces will land. It would be interesting to see if SpaceX was a bit more advanced, and if they hadn't put the space shuttle into mothballs, they might have the capacity to come and bring it down themselves. But I guess the Americans might have the ability to shoot it down, but not necessarily the ability to capture it.
And would a balloon give you a different information than just a satellite that might be up there anyway, that could presumably see a nuclear silo?
Well, yeah, I mean, if it's a geostationary satellite in above that part of Earth, it can get a lot of the same information. You'd have to, we don't know exactly what's in the balloon, but you'd have to think that the fact that it's closer might give it a better resolution in some forms. But it's very hard to know exactly what they're doing. As I say, I think it's maybe as much for show as the damage it's going to do. If the Americans were that worried about it, they would have shot it down.
Got a question in here from Shane in Sydney, who is a regular listener, and says, could you please ask Fevzi, I use the free Wi-Fi at the workers' club I go to, but is it safe to use?
No. No, it's not. And that's just for any publicly accessed Wi-Fi, be it a coffee shop or a station or anything like that. The problem is, you're joining an insecure wireless network. You're on the same network that everyone else is on that's accessing the Wi-Fi at the same time. And there are tools available. I won't go into too much detail, but there are tools available to miscreants who want to do harm and steal your information and potentially your money or your identity. They can gain access to your phone. They can put software onto it. They can interrogate the phone and examine its contents. So, no, what you should be doing, you should either use your cell network, so in other words, the data that comes with your monthly plan or your pay-as-you-go plan, so not Wi-Fi if you can avoid it. The only real Wi-Fi I would consider using is my own, and then I would secure that properly. If you absolutely do have to use a public Wi-Fi, then you should use something called a VPN, which is a virtual private network, which essentially Imagine a sort of an information pipe between your handset in that space and the internet. And the idea is that the information can flow to and from you inside this pipe without people outside being able to see what's going on inside. But VPNs themselves are not without their problems, because VPNs are often, you know, sold in terms of providing privacy. But what you're really doing is you're just changing the entity that you trust. When you connect directly to the internet, say at home, you're having to trust your internet provider. And when we say trust them, you know they're under a legal obligation to log and store every website that you visit, for example. So, but when you use a VPN, instead of trusting your internet service provider, you're having to trust a third-party company. And it's very difficult to know how trustworthy some of those companies are.
So if you were Shane in the Workers' Club, or as many, many people do in this country, they're sitting in a coffee shop somewhere with their laptop doing some work, are there certain things, when you say it's unsafe, if you're doing stuff that isn't really doesn't really matter too much, is that okay? Or could it still allow people to hack in and get stuff that matters?
It's not really okay, because it's potentially access to information on your phone, your personal information, your contact information. There's a lot of data there, eavesdropping in on any communication that's going on at that time. So, no, it's not at all okay. People tend to underestimate the value of the information, and particularly, you know, when people are being hacked, it's often that the sum of the parts is greater than, you know, the individual section. So I just think, you know, if you're going to do that, well, first advice, as I say, use your cellular data, not Wi-Fi, in a public place. If you absolutely have to use it, then use a VPN. If you're going to use a VPN, try using a paid-for VPN. The free VPNs, you have to wonder why they're there and how they make their money. You know, without being conspiratorial, there are suggestions that some of the very popular VPNs may be communicating with or even run by, you know, government organisations such as CIA, FBI, that sort of thing.
I should ask you now about mobile phones, because we've been talking about more from the social and educational side of this. At what point do you give a child a mobile phone? What's your feeling about this story?
It's very difficult. I know that a lot is spoken about using technological means to, you know, block access and so forth, and that's part of the solution. But the problem is there's no really good detail on the harms. The scientific data is incomplete, and in any event, the services and the underlying technology keep changing. And therefore, you know, if you want to do a 20 or 30 year study on the possible harms to a child, be it physical or psychological, it will be a historical document by the time it reports. So I think that when I've researched the subject myself, it seems that it has to be a whole raft of measures that have to be put into place to protect children, but also adults, I would say, and people often forget that, you know, we are powerful role models for our children when it comes to use of devices. How we use our devices often affects how our children and our older children use the devices, and it's very difficult to say, don't do as I do as I say.
Yes.
So what there is some research that shows that family contracts have a beneficial effect, that having actually a discussion about you know, what is the proper use of, for example, you know, being mentally and physically present at the dinner or at some sort of family time, that the only way that works is if the parent is willing to put their child away as well. I was sent last year. I was sent a device. It's a box. It's effectively a Faraday cage. It stops signals reaching it, and everyone has to park their phone inside the box, which has then got a timer lock on it, and it basically means that you can put it in there. It will keep it charged up, but you can't touch it for that period of time. Now, I think that's a bit of a shame if you have to go to those measures. It's much better to have this family contract and to negotiate and just be consistent in what, you know, what we're prepared to do. But I think that's only part of the problem. I think that legislation has to be part of the issue as well. I think that although the government has been messing around with an online harms bill for years and it still hasn't come to fruition, there does need to be legislation which essentially holds particularly social media companies to account for the harms that they're perceived to do, right up to jailing chief executives if they refuse. We have to, I think one should remember that at the beginning of all of this, that mobile phones themselves, the operating systems that they run, and particularly apps that run upon them, are designed with input from psychologists to make them as addictive as possible. They're designed to give us, so when you're scrolling through social media, fear of missing out. These are not accidents. These have been designed by engineers and psychologists working together to take advantage of our human weaknesses. And that has to stop. And basically, those apps should be studied by experts. They should be deconstructed and rules should be put into place. Maybe different business models that don't rely upon people being addicted and screen time being king. You know, the more time you spend on screen, the more advertising they can push. It's difficult, but you have legislation, you have technology that says, you know, block certain sites, limit access and report on what's going on. You have that, and then you have the family contract. And I think those things together, in terms, if I may just say finally, in terms of the ages, it's quite interesting. There's some statistics for the UK. 1% of under fives have got a smartphone. 6% of under eights have got a smartphone. That figure rises to 44% by age 9 and 91% in this country by age 11.
Wow.
Interestingly enough, Madonna was quoted as saying she gave her children smartphones at the age of 13 and regrets it, thinks it was too early. I think that one of the Samsung chief executive, I think it was, didn't give his children a smartphone till they were age 11.
Mm.
I think it's also to do with the maturity of the child, right? So, and your ability to communicate with the child. It's like whenever you set an age for anything, some are going to be more mature and less mature at that age, more able and less able to handle it. But we do know that children, teenagers in particular, are sensitive to social media feedback. We have to, you know, be concerned about that. And finally, you know, the UK authorities, the UK Health Security Agency, says that because of uncertainties in the science, that we should take a precautionary approach for mobile phone use with children. What they're talking about there is radiation, about the fact that children's skulls are actually, the bones are thinner and they absorb more radiation, and we could be doing untold harm. So from that point of view as well, we should try and limit. The advice is, and has been for years, that we should do our best to limit smartphone use for minors.
Yes, and that's been, as you say, that's been advice for many years and very rarely gets repeated, really. So.
Yeah, it hasn't changed. And the problem with it, again, is that the long-term studies are difficult because the underlying technology keeps changing. Some of these studies started when it was 2G and then 3G and then 4G and then 5G, and the frequencies are different, and the absorption patterns in humans are different, and the possible unintended consequences may be different. So it's very difficult to know, and to an extent the genie is out of the bottle, but we can still mitigate it. There are still things that we should do. One more thing, education. You know, we sometimes use schools to educate our children against what used to be called stranger danger, you know, how to stay safe in the physical world. We need to have similar education for all age groups, starting very young, about the dangers of the benefits, but also the potential dangers of this technology, so that children are educated and parents should be part of that education.
Absolutely. Quite a few messages coming through, including people trying out their Alexa thing. So Daryl says, if we didn't have the technology, I couldn't send you this comment, which is very true. Daryl, thank you for that one. And Eve here has said a simple question for you, Fevzi. How do I back up my contacts on my iPhone?
Right. If you've got a computer of some sort, a Mac or a Windows PC, you can download free software from Apple called iTunes, and such that when you then connect your iPhone physically to your computer, and it can be a laptop or a desktop, then it can be made to automatically back up your entire phone. Bear in mind that, you know, depending on the iPhone, that can be quite a lot of storage, so you need to make sure you've got enough space on the computer. The other alternative is that you can use iCloud for backups, and that can be very useful. So iCloud is Apple's own proprietary cloud service, and when we say cloud service, we just mean you get some space on their internet connected servers, and you can store the contents or part of the contents of your phone on there. So that can be whole backups, or you can set up an iPhone, for example, that every time you take a photo, it stores a copy of it in your cloud account. Now the thing about that is you get 5 gigabytes of storage free with your Apple ID. But you have to pay if you want more than that. Having said that, the rates are fairly affordable. I mean, they start, I think, from about £1 a month and go up from there. So that can be a really convenient solution. The downside of it is that you're putting your data into someone else's hands, although Apple, in the latest version of the operating system, have introduced the option for full end-to-end encryption where Apple don't hold the keys. And what I mean by that is you can set things up now where when you keep your data with Apple, it's all scrambled, but even Apple can't unscramble it, which is beneficial, because if law enforcement turn up and they subpoena Apple and say, we want Mr. Ball's content of Mr. Ball's phone, please, they can be able to say, no, we can't
all
do
my
it.
Recipes and everything.
You know about steganography, right? This is hiding the real data in innocuous looking data.
Oh, right. Okay. So my air fryer recipes could be hiding something else.
It's amazing what you can hide inside a picture, actually. It's quite an area of science.
How can I switch this on then?
Well, it's in the settings, basically. You can say which apps. You can say which apps can access iCloud and what they do. So that can be anything from, as I say, something as your photos going into the cloud, all the way through to entire backups. And what's really nice about that is when you buy a new device, it's very easy because you back up the old phone to the cloud, you set up the new phone, and it sets it all up for you beautifully like the old one was. The other advantage of cloud-based backups generally, and I'm not just talking about iCloud here, is that they are off-site. So if you have a burglary, if you have a fire, the danger is if you've backed up your phone onto your laptop, but your laptop's sitting on your table next to your phone, or you have a break-in, both devices can go. And therefore, you can lose your primary device and your backup as well.
And Michael has tweeted on this same subject, saying, "Does the same apply? How do I back up all my data on my Samsung phone without a computer?"
Yeah, so Samsung have got an app that you can get for your phone that will do the same thing. The other thing about smartphones is that you can often do it manually as well. When you plug a smartphone into a computer, it usually appears as an external drive from which you can navigate the folders within that drive, because essentially your smartphone is a computer, so it has a file structure where you can navigate through it and back up particular folders or groups of files, and it can be as simple as, you know, either doing it manually, drag and drop onto your computer, or you can use, let's say you're using a Windows PC or a Mac, both of them have got built-in backup software, and you can use that to back up the phone when the phone is plugged in an external device. You often have to unlock it in terms of its PIN, but you can do it that way as well. The Apple solution arguably is a little bit more elegant.
Marvellous. Well, we've just about run out of time. I really wanted to ask you about artificial intelligence as well, and our jobs being taken over by robotics, but I think we'll do that next time we speak, Fevzi. Thank you very much indeed. That's Fevzi Turkalp, editor of GadgetDetective.com and host of the Gadget Detective podcast, and he's on Twitter as well, so if you weren't able to get an answer to your question, check him out on Twitter at Gadget Detective, and I'm sure he will attempt to reply to any questions that come along.